Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to the School of Successful Ranching. I hope everyone enjoyed a very good lunch. Before we get started, I do ask that everyone turn off their cell phones or silence them and remove your hats. There is a table in the back if anyone would like to place their hat on the table. And before we get started, I would like to take a moment to thank our sponsors. We do want everyone to make sure they go visit our sponsors in the Expo Center and give them a big thank you for allowing us to hold this program. Our sponsors are Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Corteva, the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Rabo Agrifinance, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, and the Texas Beef Quality Assurance Program. Our next presentation is Cows and Bulls, Making Informed Beef Cattle Breeding Decisions, presented by David Roper of Tarleton State University. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank y'all. Can everybody hear me all right with this microphone? If I need to sit up or down. All right. And so I'm not going to use the podium. I have a version of those. I like to move around a lot. So my students have me in class. No, I'm prone to walk up and down the aisle. So there'll be no pop quiz today. This will be on the test, though, within this semester, okay? That's always a common question we get at school. But hopefully that didn't fall on deaf ears. I know you all just got through eating lunch. But hopefully what we talk about today will be helpful. Looking through the program and the summary of this afternoon's talk is pretty extensive. We can spend a long time talking about making informed decisions. There's lots of information out there that you can utilize. And you're going to hear me repeat several things over and over again this afternoon. It's like a broken record at times. It's what fits you, and you got to do things that match your environment, and it kind of depends. And the answer, you know, kind of depends on what you need. So those are going to be some of the things we hear over and over and over again this afternoon as we go through this afternoon's presentation. And so the principle's simple, right? We're trying to make calves. So we take a bull, we breed it to a cow, and we get a calf. That's a simple answer and a simple solution to this problem. Now, the rest of this, though, is it's more complex than that. There's all kinds of tools we can utilize, and they are tools. And we're going to talk a lot about this afternoon about visual evaluation, genetics, EPDs, ratios, and then how we can incorporate that with our individual male and female selection. But they're tools, all right? And so don't get overwhelmed. Don't focus on too many things. Start simple. Identify the goals that you need for your operation. Implement those changes slowly. It's very easy to get bombarded with all the data we have in the cattle industry today from a genetic standpoint, visual standpoint, whatever it may be, but you got to figure out what is needed for your individual operation. Identify your selection priorities. What do you have versus what you need? All right. And so I like to refer to this as a checklist versus a grocery list. All right. So a checklist identifies the specific things that you need. You check those off. Grocery list says you go buy everything you need and it's a big old mass amount. All right. So if you don't have muscle or carcass traits, you put that on your checklist. You find what you need to fix those things. We do that for any of our traits, maternal traits, growth traits. We're going to talk about some examples this afternoon and kind of maybe hopefully answer a few questions, and hopefully at the same time we generate more questions, all right? So there's going to be some things that we're going to get answered and hopefully maybe provide some clarity with, but at the same time, hopefully generate some more questions and add to this conversation for the future. So this afternoon we're going to talk a little bit about visual phenotypic selection, and then I know I work with the judging programs at Tarleton and have other places as well, and so no, we're not worried about show ring phenotype necessarily as in some of our commercial cattle productions. There are some visual and some phenotypic traits are still important. Longevity, structure, muscle are still important. Okay, we're going to talk about that a little bit. Talk about genetics in terms of EPDs, indexes, genomic EPDs, just briefly. We can spend days talking about some of these things, all right? We can spend multiple conversations and discussions about those specifically. Pedigree selection methods, performance selection methods, how we decide who is going to be utilized as our parent stock. So first we're going to talk about basic structural or visual traits. So this is kind of a generic list that I provide for most of our students that we work with either on the judging programs or in our production classes at Tarleton. I think it's very relevant from a commercial standpoint. Structure is important no matter what phase of the industry we're in. Breeding stock, terminal stock, doesn't matter. Those animals have got to be able to move. They got to be able to walk. Feet and leg correctness is important, all right? Rib shape, body shape, efficiency, capacity, room for gestation, thinking about females. Muscling, reproductive traits, udders, all those have importance from a visual selection standpoint. We can't overlook those. We need to provide some emphasis for those as well, all right? So structure, we mentioned a second ago, improved comfort and efficiency. We need these animals to have some longevity. A cow or a bull does us no good if they're around for a single breeding season, single year, and then they're gone because they're not structurally integrity, have the structural integrity in order to get out and perform in a pasture-based setting. All right, so it improves their functionality, improves their longevity, and there's some questionability in terms of heritability in some of those traits as well. Can we make improvements, or can we make bad selection decisions and make more problematic structural animals as well? So we've got to be careful when we start to think about finding those animals that are structurally correct. Pay attention to the feet and legs. Pay attention to the angle to their skeleton. And it's important for maternal setting, all right? Feedlot steers, feedlot heifers, the ones that are more comfortable, they're going to get up, they're going to eat, they're going to drink, all right? Ones that are bad structure, they're going to lay down in the corner, they're not going to get up and be as efficient. And so our parent stock have a role in producing those animals as well. So for every bad structured feedlot animal in the world, there's some parent stock or some siblings to that animal that's still in production somewhere. And so they still have to pay some importance from that standpoint as well. So when we think about skeletal correctness, I like to kind of start at a couple different places, all right? And so we tend to think about front-end skeleton, hind-end skeleton as being separated, but they're actually connected. So the old nursery rhyme, head bone connected to neck bone, everything's still interrelated to each other. And so we like for these animals to have about a 45-degree angle to their shoulder. And so we tend to look at how that shoulder blade lays onto their body. And we can use some visual cues of how that animal is constructed. Animals that tend to carry their head down closer to the ground, they tend to be a little straighter fronted, okay? And so that shoulder angle is not as correct. So we might want about a 45-degree angle from the top of their shoulder down to the point of the shoulder. If we do that, the rest of their skeleton tends to connect together and be ideally structured. So we want about a slight backward curvature at their knee and about a 45-ish or so angle in their pastern as well. So we get those animals that are straight-shouldered, they get straight in their knee, they get straight in their front pastern, they get kind of post-legged up front. Same thing from behind. And we want these animals to have a slight slope to their hip, if you will. We don't want them to be perfectly dead level, and we don't want them to be too steep as well. So if we start to drop that in that hip bone further down, we push that stifle joint forward, we push the hawk angle back, we change the angle of that pastern as well, and we get those animals that kind of get up underneath themselves. Those animals have problems during mating season. Those bulls start to mount them, and everything about females, or those bulls try to mount those females, they have some hind-end structure that's not comfortable. They start to get deterioration in their joints or hurt themselves and stifle themselves, and those animals aren't going to be out there and be productive and be functional. So we've got to pay attention to that along with how those hooves are structured. Big, square, solid foundation in terms of hoof. We don't want those hooves that are curled or twisted, that screw toe kind of, you know, claw type of structure. We want those things to be even in toe size and square, provide a big foundation for that animal to step down on. Yeah. So from a real world, it has some application. And so being able to withstand that mating pressure, either from the female side or the male side, having the ability to jump and mount those animals from a bull, and if we're talking about young heifers, withstanding that weight of that male mounting them during breeding season. So there's real-world tangibility and real-world application for that, and it's not to be overlooked. Body volume, so shape of rib cage, depth of forerib, width of skeleton. Texas Extension 4-H group put out some pictures recently that do a really nice job of defining and describing all these areas and what we're looking for. And when I put this together, I did not have the opportunity to borrow that from them, but take a look and search for it. They have a really nice picture that describes forerib, describes body, length of body, width, all those different things. Those become important from ability to consume feed, forage, gestate, everything about females. And so we tend to put a little more emphasis on body on our female side. Those are the ones that have got to get out there, consume some forage in a pasture-based setting, convert that to gain, be able to maintain their body reserves while they're gestating. And at the same time, we think about lactation on that animal too. They've got to pull double duty. They've got to raise that calf as well as get rebred in order to be productive and efficient and hopefully be profitable at the same time. Muscling, so carcass traits we know are highly heritable. And so we can make both rapid positive and negative changes or and corrections or improvements or detriments to our operation. And so if we overlook muscle and do not focus on that, we can make a lot of muscle animals that are not going to be as profitable or as efficient. Muscle needs to match sex type. It's always one of the things I try to drive into our students at school. We want our females to look like females. We want our males to look like males. So we try to let the terminal emphasis come from the male side as much as possible. All right. It's also important to differentiate this from fat. That's one of the hardest things to do is to read through that skin, read through that fat layer to assess how much muscle is actually in that animal. And so one thing to kind of take home from today, if nothing else, is think about that animal's skeleton, if it was a bare bones structure, skeleton there standing in front of us, and then lay the muscle over top of that first, then the fat, then the skin. And that's how everything's going to be kind of laid on there. And so animals that are heavy muscled, they're going to be wider based at the ground, have more shape in terms of width down their top or from behind. And those fat animals are going to, for lack of a technical way, be jiggly, right? They're going to have more depth and exaggerated depth relative to their body, okay? So that muscle's going to lay tight on that skeleton, and it's going to be more related in from a relationship standpoint to their frame, to their extension, to their height. Whereas fat, when we lay that over the top of the muscle, over the top of the skeleton, they're going to be exaggerating their body depth. They're going to be a little wastier in their appearance. And a lot of times, they just have a general rounder appearance. When you start to look at those fat animals from above, they are very round, especially compared to their width of the ground. So if you see an animal, if you have some animals at home that are really wide-topped and they're really narrow at the ground, chances are there's some extra excess conditions, some excess fat there on those animals, all right? And so being able to read through those is going to be important. Reproductive traits, all right? So udders, testicles, penis. We're talking about BSEs and males here in a little bit as well. But we need to think about that and have some thought process when we think about reproductive traits. So in general, most of our reproduction traits are lowly heritable. We can make slow changes over generations, long generations of time. You can make some slow improvements. But reproductive problems have a direct negative impact on the present production. Bulls that aren't fertile today are going to directly impact your calf production for the next year. Cows that go open for a year decrease your production, decrease your profitability, decrease your efficiency. So we have to pay attention to reproductive traits here and now and today to have the ability to make more progeny and make better gains, hopefully, in our operations as a whole. So decreased pregnancy, more cows open, decreased calf gains from an udder issue as well. So making sure we're paying attention to quality of udders, design of udder, teat placement, teat design, making sure that calf can actually get on, attach, and suckle those cows is going to be important. All right? So kind of switch gears a little bit, and I apologize, maybe a little bit of a shotgun approach to some of these, but we've got some broad topics to get through this afternoon. And so genetic selection is probably one of the areas that many of you have some questions or may not be as comfortable with in terms of how do you utilize it, what they are. And so I was taught and had a very interesting concept instilled in me once upon a time that even on a commercial setting, we may not have EPDs. We may not have registered cattle, but we know those better performers, right? We know the cows that make better calves. We know the cows that milk better and raise bigger calves. And so we still have some genetic information. We may not have it in the true textbook form of EPDs or ratios, but we still know those better ones from our production records. And we have an ideal. And so we can use that as some clues to help us, all right? So we're going to kind of talk about some examples of EPDs, indexes or dollar figures, ratios. And then kind of conclude our genetic section here with some genomic enhanced EPDs as well, all right? And so we got to keep in mind that performance of livestock, whether it be cattle or any other species, is a combination of their genetics plus their environment. And so even if we have the ideal set of genetics in those animals, without the proper inputs and the proper management from an environmental standpoint, we may not achieve all of those genetic gains we're hoping to get. All right, so keep that in mind. We're going to kind of come back to that as well. So as you're trying to implement genetic improvements and utilize EPDs or EBVs or ratios to improve your operation, your production, if you don't feed those cows, if you don't manage those bulls correctly, you're not going to gain all of your true genetic performance from those animals. So what is an estimated progeny, or expected progeny difference? Excuse me. So the estimate of genetic value of an animal is a parent, all right? So that's kind of the textbook definition. So all it does is, all we're saying is we're predicting the performance of that progeny, all right? And so it's same or it's equivalent across that breed. So the one limitation we have with EPDs is we can't make direct comparison across breeds. We can't adjust for that, and there are some equations we can utilize to put everything on a similar basis, but we are trying to predict the performance of that animal in the next generation. All right, so kind of how can we use this? What does this mean? All right, so let's kind of look at a winning weight example here. We've got two different bulls, bull A and B. A's got a positive 30 winning weight EPD. Bull B's got a positive 10 winning weight EPD. So if we kind of put that on maybe a little easier to visualize example, bull A would produce calves that on average weigh 600 pounds compared to bull B would be 580 pounds. So 20 pounds difference in winning weight value or gains or weight. And so if we're selling on weaning weight basis, that extra 20 pounds is extra, you know, an extra 20 pounds per calf on average. That's extra dollars and extra profitability, hopefully, back in our operation. All right, so kind of a very simple example and a simple explanation of how we can use that. So we can use that same scenario, same example, for any kind of trait that we're looking at that we want to make improvements on or make corrections on. It's important to understand that breeds, and these EPDs are on a breed average basis, and they're not all zero, okay? And so breed average for individual traits are going to vary across the breed. They're going to vary across the year, and even sometimes within the year, depending on how often those individual breeds update their EPDs and their breed averages. So that makes it a little bit of a challenge at times to compare across breeds, but you can, we can use some formulas and make some corrections and some adjustments to calculate those on a similar basis to make some estimations as well. All right. So, So some specific maternal traits you may want to put emphasis on or focus on growth traits along with that. So birth weight, weaning weight, yearling weight, milk EPDs, all those are kind of termed some of our more maternal and growth traits. Okay. And so if you're not sure what we mean by some of those different phrases or definitions, when we think about maternal traits, we think about those traits the dam can influence that calf on, whether it be birth weight or weaning weight from a milk standpoint, yearling weight in terms of genetic growth that may come from both female or the male side, either one. So kind of the same example, depending on what you're trying to emphasize or what you're trying to make improvements on, you're going to put some different selection emphasis within those different categories. One thing that we hear a lot about in the cattle industry is low birth weight bulls, heifer bulls. And so do you need to pay attention to calvinese or birth weight? The answer is probably both a little bit. Kind of, you know, those are traits that go hand in hand and work very closely related to each other. And so calvinese we term as a trait of interest, and birth weight is an indicator trait of calvinese. Right? So in theory, lower birth weight calves should come easier. I say in theory because those of y'all that have calved cows, you know that's not always the case depending on how that animal's constructed. Bigger headed ones, bigger shouldered ones, small pelvis females. There's a lot of variabilities that go into that that maybe prevent that. But those two are closely related, and if we select for improvements in one, we can theoretically make improvements in the other as well. So we also have calvinese direct or calvinese maternal in terms of percent unassisted births or percent of daughters that calve unassisted as well. So it kind of depends, again, on some breed specificity and individual preference for your operation too, where you may want to put more emphasis if you're keeping daughters back or if you're trying to make improvements in your own or in that initial production within that given year. And so there's a whole list and slew of other EPDs that we're not going to get into and touch on this afternoon. And again, like I've already mentioned, you need to figure out what you need versus what you have or what you want and have in your operation. So if you're trying to make improvements in carcass, we talked about heritability of carcass traits being high a second ago. We may want to emphasize ribeye area, intermuscular fat, IMF, marbling, depending on the breed we're talking about, carcass weight, yield grade, especially if you're doing retained ownership or if you're having some long-term contracts with feedlots and packing houses, that type of deal, you may be putting some emphasis on some of those. If you're thinking about maternal traits, you're thinking about keeping your own replacement females, then some of those longevity traits, stayability is an example that you may want to put some emphasis on. There's some new reproduction traits that are out there in some of the breeds, so some daughter fertility, daughter pregnancy EPDs are becoming available, and we can use those to make some improvements in reproduction as well. Even though they may be slower and a little bit heritable, we may make some improvements slowly over time. It's like we've already mentioned a good bit this afternoon. Key is determining what is right for you. Figure out what you need and utilize the traits that are important to you. One of the problems that go along, we've already mentioned a couple of challenges with EPDs, and the other problem we have is balancing those traits across each other. And so if we're using an example from a single trait selection, if we're trying to make improvements in winning weight, we tend to increase our birth weight as well. And so if we increase our wing weight too high, we run into stosh issues. All right? So balance those traits and figuring out which traits are important and how much of a gain that you need in your operation is going to balance in where you're going to be putting some emphasis. So how are the economics and the relevance of that trait, the unit change, important for your operation and that single trait selection kind of mentality and being mindful and being careful. If I make two big improvements, positive improvements in one trait, I may make negative improvements in another one. And so one of the other tools that we have from a genetic standpoint that helps us combat making just purely in textbook single trait selection emphasis is through the use of ratios or these dollar indexes. And so a lot of breeds have developed these, and they've been around for a long time from some standpoints. But it's a combination of weighting of multiple traits and their relevance from an economic standpoint. And so we can make directional changes in more than one trait by utilizing a single number. Right? So it allows us to balance improvements, balance selection by utilizing a single number instead of trying to balance birth weight by itself versus wing weight versus urine weight or carcass trait. So it allows us to utilize several different pieces of information in an easier to understand single number. And so very simple or similar in terms of concept to EPD. So instead of being on a small decimal basis, it's typically on a $100 basis or a 100 ratio basis type of deal. And we're talking about dollar figures in terms of improvement within those particular traits. So challenging to develop, essentially, but simple to use in practice. Okay, we can look at one from an example in a second on a dollar W basis, and if they're higher dollar W, there's more value potentially in that particular animal from improvements in those traits. Yeah. And so kind of we alluded to that a second ago there. So dollar W is wing calf value as an example, and predicts advantages in both birth weight, weaning weight, maternal milk, and mature cow size. So it balances all those things into one single number. And just like with our EPDs a second ago, bull A would be $30 versus bull B at $20. And so bull A is going to provide us $10 increase in advantages for birth weight, weaning weight, maternal milk, and mature cow size. And so we can use that single number to balance all those things together to make improvements in those particular traits. Right. And so another example, again, so from a different breed standpoint, Baldy Maternal Index maximizes profit for commercial producers utilizing Hereford bulls on Angus cross females. So we kind of take advantage of some of those improvements, those heterosis, that type of deal that you probably have heard in other situations as well. And we kind of assume we're taking some ownership and marketing on a grid basis. So the point being, depending again on your situation, your operation, and what you need, there's specific ratios or dollar figures that may be applicable to you. And the point also being is don't get lost in the fray. Read through, work through, and target what you need. Don't get blinded for all the numbers that are out there, because there are a plethora of them out there. Wade through and figure out what you need specifically to make improvements in your own operation. It's also important to understand that bulls or animals that have similar dollar figures are not going to be equal. All right, so here's an example of that in terms of bull A and bull B, both having a dollar W value the same, but there's big differences in those other traits. All right, so I can gain that same improvement from weaning weight, birth weight, maternal milk, and cow size with both those bulls, but if I'm thinking about breeding two virgin heifers, depending on my situation, I may not want to use bull A. I may want to use bull B and take advantage of those smaller birth weights. So point being is that there's similarities in some of those traits, but what those bulls bring in other areas may be more important to you than other ones. All right. So kind of, again, balance those things with what you have versus what you need versus what you're trying to make improvements in. And so we know, or how do we know that some of these EPDs or these ratios or dollar figures are accurate? And we base that off of our accuracy. And so those of y'all that may be not sure what we mean by accuracy, if you've seen those on some of the EPDs, the data we have out there, it's a correlation between actual breeding value and estimated breeding value of that animal. So in a perfect situation, the accuracy will be a 1. So 100% relationship. Where no relationship, it would be a 0. And so most of our young sires are low, 15.15, 0.20, 0.30, something like that. Our more utilized AI sires, the more data we have, the more progeny we have out of those sires, that accuracy and that relationship goes up. We have more confidence in that predictability of that EPD. And so what we mean by that is when we have these high accuracy bulls, our relationship is considerably closer, and our reliability and our change value of that EPD is smaller. Whereas if we have these animals that are low accuracy, known as kind of exampled by this dotted line here, we have more variability, more option for our actual EPD or actual performance of that calf to be further out here on these tails. Okay? And so the more accurate they are, the higher that relationship is, the more reliable and more sure we are that that actual performance is going to be what we see based on the predictability or prediction of that EPD. So the last one we're going to think about from a genetic standpoint is genomically enhanced EPDs. So fairly new, if you will, in the grand scheme of some of our genetic traits that we have or genetic tools that we have. But it's a use of DNA tests, performance tests, progeny tests, of all those, or progeny, excuse me. It's designed to improve accuracy of younger bulls. So we can get some information and improve the accuracy of those younger bulls faster by utilizing this information. So it's based on relationship of those animals to other bulls with known data, known results, known progeny information. So it allows us to make faster improvements, get those younger sires into production quicker, and have some more confidence in their ability to actually do what hopefully their EPDs say they're going to do. All right. So how do we use the genetic data? And so we need to identify a level of change that's desired in your operation. Identify the specific traits that you need. And again, we've mentioned quite a bit already this afternoon that these are tools and they're specific to what you need. Know the unit of measure for that trait as well. Right? So is it pounds? Is it marbling score? Is it dollars? Understand that as well. And then pay attention to the accuracy so you're relatively sure that what you're trying to accomplish is actually going to be accomplished. So, as one of my grad students likes to say from time to time, now what? So what? Who cares? All right. Should I use visual selection? Should I use EPDs? Should I use a dollar index or a ratio? Or what about genomically enhanced EPDs? What should you use? All right. How should you use it? The answer is, short answer is yes. You know, again, I mentioned a good bit already that these are tools. And they're only as good as your application and your implementation of them. But, yes, we should be utilizing this information. Even though we've kind of highlighted a few challenges with some of them, they're still valuable. They're still our best tools we have in order to make improvements, in order to make gains. More specifically, though, like we've already mentioned as well, determine what your operational needs are. Determine what your environmental needs are. Right? Everybody's situation is different. Just because one producer may need excess or an increase in milk, their pasture setting, their forage setting, their nutritional inputs may allow them to do that. Right? If you're in a drier range condition, you select and emphasize milk, you're going to have to provide some nutritional supplementation to those animals to compensate that at times as well. So environmental factors need to play a part of that as well. Establish some selection methods within your own operation as well. We've got several different tools that we can utilize from a single trait selection. We've kind of highlighted some issues with that. The tandem selection system, more example from a ratio dollar figure standpoint, and or some independent culling levels. Having some culling criteria set that are unique and specific to individual traits will allow you to make rapid improvements in more than one area and or make adjustments as well. So like we already mentioned, again, determine what you need, determine your goals, identify the traits that you need, and then go find those and put those in practice. All right? And so from a sire-specific selection standpoint, we can make most, if not all, of our genetic progress through sire selection. And so my math's going to get a little funky here in a second, but I always have maintained and use example that a sire accounts for more than 50% of the genetic changes, whether it be positive or negative improvements in a particular herd. And so if you think about it from a math standpoint, more than 50% plus 50% is more than 100%, right? But if you think about it, a bull is hopefully going to service more than one female a year. And so the selection that you put on that bull is extremely important in your production and your efficiency, or hopefully in your profitability of your operation in the next year. You make a poor decision this year, you're going to live with those consequences next year in your calf crop, all right? And so we can make that some progress through that accurate and a good decision from a sire selection standpoint. Specifically, we tend to try to, and generally, let the male provide the terminal side of things. Let them provide the muscle. Let them provide some of the carcass traits, the extra growth traits. They can be a little harder body. And I use that a little bit sparingly and safely, because you still got to feed that bull. But it's easier to feed a single bull a little bit more to maintain himself than it is to feed 25, 50, 100, whatever how many cows you may have to maintain themselves as well. So those bulls can get by with providing some more terminal traits without sacrificing overlooking those maternal traits, the calf knees, birth weight, some of those traits that are important on the maternal side of things. We haven't touched on reproduction yet. It's extremely important to think about sire reproduction, scroll circumference particularly. We've got the EPDs that allow us to predict scroll circumference of those bulls. And from a production standpoint, larger scroll circumference bulls have an increased daily sperm output, so they can service more females. They also have correlation to larger testicles, have higher quality sperm. So not only they have a larger sperm output, they also have a better quality sperm. And so in theory, from a fertility standpoint, we can service more females and settle more of those females. We also know that onset of puberty is reached earlier in those larger scrolling bulls as well. So if we make some emphasis and some selection for that, we can get those daughters in production sooner and turn over that generation in a little bit quicker with those females and those larger scrolling bulls. And so in order to accomplish this, we still need to be utilizing other selection tools or measurement tools like breeding status exams, reproductive anatomy assessment, making sure the testicles are designed correctly, the pieces and parts are there, and along with that, the semen motility and morphology is going to be acceptable enough for that animal to hopefully get those females pregnant. And I say hopefully because the breeding status exam is only a snapshot of fertility or traits at that one particular point in time. It's not predictive of their ability 40 days from now, 100%, but that's our best guess estimate. So it's a single snapshot in time and prediction of what they can do and hopefully can do over the course of a breeding season. On the flip side of that, we can make progress through culling of dams. Right? And so identify those problems, remove the problems from the cow herd, require some accurate records, require some clear culling selection criteria. So I talked about a minute ago, establishing the selection methods, establishing those selection criteria, and then kind of in quotes there, stick to your guns. We've all had that that set of females or that one female in particular that we've all kind of been kind of partial to. Over the years, and the year she comes up open, it's kind of hard to kill her, right, at times. But if we're going to truly make progress, if we're going to truly make improvements, we've got to stick to our guns and approach it from a management standpoint, a business standpoint, and if they're not being profitable, if they're not raising the calf, if they're not producing the calf, those are the ones that we need to identify, and we need to cull those problems out of the herd. So from a selection standpoint, dam traits, we need to focus on maternal traits, all right? We know, even in a commercial setting, we know those cows that raise the bigger calves. We know those cows are the mothers. So we can use that information, even though it may not be a formal genetic piece of information in terms of EPD, we still know those cows are the better performing. We can match that information with the EPDs that we do have on our bull side of things. So we balance that with carcass traits and our terminal traits to hopefully make improvements if we need to. And then also being mindful and paying attention to udder quality and making sure that we have acceptable udder, teat size, teat placement, freedom from mastitis, and those health issues that go along with that as well. Yeah. So kind of let's put this into production or put this in example here. So we've got a set of cows here, A, B, C, D. The green box kind of highlights some of the maternal traits, those growth traits that we have present within this particular set of cows. And if you kind of take a second, go through there and look at those, for the most part, all those cows are either at or better than breed average. There's a couple of exceptions in there, particularly in milk. A couple of our cows are maybe just a little bit below breed average for our milk traits. But the one thing that that we are deficient in is some of our carcass traits. And so if we're trying to make improvements, if we're trying to take advantage of some retained ownership, or if we're trying to take advantage of some contracts on a carcass basis, that's a particular area of deficiency in this particular cow herd that we need to try to target and make some bull selection, some sire selection, in order to correct that and make changes for that. All right, and so kind of we've already talked about and highlight and hopefully kind of get the point from today is take advantage of what you have or take stock of what you have versus what you need to get to whatever marketing goal or input that you're trying to accomplish. All right. So one thing that we got to keep in mind, I mentioned it earlier as well, is we make increases in performance, we may need to provide some additional supplements. So if we're trying to increase weaning weight, if we're trying to increase maternal milk, those females may need more nutritional inputs, they need more energy, wherever it may be. Same thing if we're trying to make improvements in growth and we're trying to select for higher weaning weights, higher yielding weights, we need to be prepared for the potential for dystocia issues. We need to make selection decisions on the female side of things for larger pelvis, bigger frame, wherever they, you know, whatever you may need to accomplish in order to get the type of cow you need is going to match up to your selection goals you're trying to accomplish. All right, so as you kind of move forward, we mentioned it a little bit already, so utilize a checklist. Right? Don't use a grocery list. I mean, used that example a little bit earlier in the afternoon here. And so take stock of what you need and don't just go buy a bull or a cow just because they have 2 ears and 4 legs and they're walking around. So take a second to take an inventory of what you need from a genetic standpoint or a production standpoint and find those animals that are going to make those improvements for you. And on top of that, and probably most importantly, we've kind of mentioned a little bit as well, identify genetics that fit. All right, we've kind of alluded to that a little bit as well earlier. And so the type of cow, the type of bull that's going to fit the Gulf Coast versus the Panhandle of Texas are totally different. The type of genetic information that you're going to utilize is totally different. All right, so take advantage of that or take some time to think about what you need in your particular environmental settings and adapt for that and select for that. All right. So with that, I know that may have been a little quick, but I want some time for questions. Everybody still reading my joke? Hopefully it's not too early after lunch. Yes, sir.
So the EPDs, I understand what they are, but a lot of cases, I don't know, is it based on several years of history for the sires and the females? Because I'll see people going on regular reporting what the weaning weight is and things like that for all the sex.
Right. So EPDs so the question is how do we calculate EPDs? And so those are calculated at the breed associations, and so it's based on the performance data that's submitted to that breed association with those calves produced out of those animals. And so they'll make adjustments periodically. It's a breed-by-breed difference on if it's yearly, six-monthly, quarterly, whatever it may be. And so it's on the purebred side of things and that information that is being submitted. And so part of that challenge is it's as good as information that's being submitted as well. And so that's where the accuracy has that value to help us assure the predictability of those EPDs, if you will. Yes, sir. Certainly, potentially. Yeah. Yes, sir. So Quay. Go ahead. Okay. Right. Right. Yes, sir. Yeah. Right. Yes, sir. And so kind of the question are the EPDs, are they as accurate as the person submitting them? And correct, is that the assessment of your question? Information put in. Right. Yes, sir. And so, yes, there's some human factor in that. And so that's where the genomically enhanced EPDs have some advantage. Because it's based on the genetics and the actual pedigree, not his pedigree, but the true genetic component of that bull. And you can't, I don't want to use this term necessarily, but you can't tweak that or fudge that necessarily. It's what it is what it is. And so, yes, there is potential that I think we all would understand without that those EPDs are as good as the data that's being submitted. And at times, the moral character of some people may factor in some of that as well. And so we need to hopefully all be on the same page and all do things correctly. But that is, yes, unfortunately, that is part of a potential problem, where that's where some of the genomically enhanced EPDs have some advantage to take care of that, along with the accuracy as well. And so accuracy is going to come with more progeny, more data turned in, and in order to get a large amount of data that comes from a cross herd setting. So this bull being used in multiple operations across the nation is going to help us prevent some of those issues as well. Yes, sir. And individual variation too. I mean, just because a bull has or a cow has EPDs. There are individual variation is how that genetics line up and where those that DNA segregates during embryonic development. There are going to be some variation in those animals as well. So it's not just clear cut as we make it out to be sometimes. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Any other questions? Russell, no questions? Well, thank y'all. I appreciate it. Hopefully I didn't confuse you any more than you already were when you got here. Hopefully you have some more clarity on a few issues. But if you have questions in the future I can help you with, don't hesitate to contact us, contact me. If I don't know the answer, I'll lie. No, I'll find an answer for you. But really appreciate y'all coming, and let me know if there's anything I can help you with once you get home. Any questions? Thank y'all.